Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are taught our brain is the center of our intelligence. It commands the body. Cognitive scientist Guy Claxton says, hold on. It's true, he says. We've given the brain more and more standing as we retreat to keyboard and screen, text and symbols. But the intelligence of the entire body is fundamental, he says, and we're a lesser species without it, without using it. He wants us to re-engage the whole, see it. This hour on Point, intelligence in the flesh. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we too focused on the brain, the stuff between our ears, too ready to float away from the wisdom in our flesh and bones? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Brighton, England, is Guy Claxton. He's a prominent cognitive scientist. His forthcoming book, out next week, is Intelligence in the Flesh: Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. It's the third in a series of books he's written on the mind, human intelligence, the wayward mind, harebrained, tortoise mind. John Cleese said of harebrained, it is the essential guide to creativity. Guy Claxton, thanks for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're talking here about embodied cognition. What is that?
Well, it's an attempt to redress a view of the mind or of human intelligence, which has been around for a very long time, probably since the classical Greeks and all the way up through Western civilization, as we call it. And there's just been a view that things that are more abstract or more conscious or more cerebral are somehow more worthy of our attention. And the poor old body, what St. Francis referred to as brother ass, gets a bit of a hard time. And the new research in embodied cognition is saying, hold on a minute, if you actually look at the data, if you actually look in detail at your own experience, you find that the body is much more implicated. The mind and the body are stitched together, not set apart from each other. And I think more people need to know about this. I think it's interesting and I think it's important.
You're talking about what you call a cultural rebellion against the hegemony of the intellect. Explain that.
Well, I just think the intellect is a very useful tool in helping us function well and be happy and make good decisions. But it's come to really be the kind of cuckoo in the nest of the human cognitive system. And I think we need to just say, take stock and say, okay, mate, you're useful. Your scalpel-like ability to dissect and analyze and rationalize. But there are many other aspects to being a smart person which are not quite so clear-cut, and we need to play with the whole deck rather than just prioritizing or celebrating just one aspect of our intelligence. So it's kind of cutting the rational mind down to size a little bit or putting it back in context.
You quote Yeats, of course, the great poet, saying, we only believe in those thoughts which have been conceived not in the brain, but in the whole body. What exactly does that mean? I mean, I can imagine people thinking of a bicep or a quad and wondering, wait a minute, where's the brain power there?
Sure. When Yeats says we only believe, what he means is we give value to things that affect us viscerally. There are forms of understanding in which the body is very intimately and intricately involved. For example, when we're touched or moved by something, which is a very deep form of understanding or engagement, the words themselves tell us what's going on. We're touched. We're physically touched. Our skin flushes or crawls or creeps with excitement. We're moved. We feel something in our guts, in our insides. And that's because we're built as a kind of species around things that are of concern to us, things that matter to us. We're not abstract thinkers. We're doers and feelers at our roots. And our kind of our civilization in some ways has tried to take us away from those roots as if they were sort of more bestial or more primitive in some way or other. But the evidence is, even when you're thinking abstractly, those visceral roots are still active. They're still down there in the practical concerns of us as human beings. So we should acknowledge that.
Talk about the science of that then. You describe almost a distributed mind or distributed brain. It's not just between our ears. It really involves every part of our body and in some ways beyond involves the extensions of our body and tools. What does it mean, though, in scientific terms?
Well, what it means is, I mean, let's start by just having a look at the body. The body isn't an assembly of organs and systems. It's actually one big system. And particularly, it's a big information system. So there are hundreds of conversations going on inside your body around what's of concern, what's in balance, what's out of balance. The different bits of the body are talking to each other the whole time. There's a kind of cacophony of crosstalk going on in the body, muscles talking to muscles as we shift our weight in one part of our body so other parts are engaged. We know that our gut talks directly to our heart. There are little mini brains scattered around all over the body which are busy talking to each other. And they need to do that in order to kind of keep us on the level, to keep us going. But because we're large organisms, we also need to coordinate those things. We need to have a kind of central committee that resolves competing concerns or competing disputes. So we need a brain. But the brain is the kind of chat room of the body, I would call it, rather than the command center. We've misunderstood. The brain between our ears is necessary. It's like the common room where all these different conversations can come together and they can thrash out their differences and agree on a corporate plan of action. The word corporate, of course, mm-hmm. refers to the body. Mm-hmm. So there isn't any kind of big boss. There isn't any chief executive sitting between our ears, which is the kind of folk psychological notion, if you will. There is just a conversation which has to resolve what's going on in real time and come up with a best plan. But that conversation is involving constant streaming of information from the heart, from the stomach, from the feelings in the viscera, from what's going on in your skin, from what's coming in through your senses, and trying to kind of make sense of the whole thing. So in a way, I think it's more accurate to say the body is the brain. The brain is the whole. The intelligent organ is the whole thing, not just the bit between our ears.
Maybe I'm just trapped in folk psychology here, but I understand the body as a sensor, but the streams of information don't. I mean, we have this picture of the nervous system taking all this information up to what can seem like the executive function in the brain, where it's all decided upon. That everything else is just sensors.
It seems like that, and that's an interpretation. But if you look more carefully at the physiology, as I say, there's a huge amount of crosstalk going on within the body. And also information is streaming up and streaming down at such a rate that, you know, the brain, if something happens in your gut, what's going on in your brain is affected by it. If some shift happens in your brain, within less than a second, you're being affected, your muscles are being affected, your gut is being affected. So in effect, we're stitched together in real time like one big, complicated, pulsating system. And as I say, we need the facility to be able for all these different conversations to kind of come together and thrash out their differences. But that's very different from saying there's some center of intelligence which is different from the body, which is having to sort of impose commands and structure on everything else. There's no central executive. There is just a conversation which becomes conscious when it's particularly complex, that conversation. Most of the time it isn't even conscious. So it's a different way of looking at how we make decisions or how we prioritize or how we deal with tricky conflicts. It's a the medieval world would be, you know, we have a moot where people come together and moot their differences and sort them out. And that applies to different bits of the body just as much as they did in a traditional community.
Guy Claxton writes that the mind is not parachuted in to save and supervise some otherwise helpless concoction of dumb meat. He says it's just the other way around. But if we misperceive or misconceive that, what's the cost?
Well, the cost is a sort of denigration of the body. There's a recent study, for example, which looks at whether you're a kind of hard-nosed dualist. That's to say, whether you think there's a really strong separation between your mind, your conscious thoughts, and what goes on in your body, or whether you have a more mixed or intermingled view of things. Does it matter? It certainly does. If you try and flip people into one or other of those views by priming them or giving them a task, saying, you know, here's a view, the dualist view, the mind and the body are very different and separated, and here's some information about it. Now make some notes about how you would explain that view to someone else. Or you give them the other view, the mixed view, which says mind and body are much closer together than we thought. Then you send them off for lunch. And you call them back again after lunch because they think they're doing a different kind of experiment. And you ask them what they had for lunch. The people who are the most strongly dualistic chose less healthy options. Isn't that interesting?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about human intelligence way beyond the brain. The intelligence often untapped these days, says my guest, throughout the human body. Guy Claxton, cognitive scientist out of the UK, joins us from Brighton. His new book is Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. You can read an excerpt. It's really worth checking out at our website, onpointradio.org. He's author of The Wayward Mind and Harebrained Tortoise Mind, Why Intelligence Increases When You Think Less. Here's the sound of an awful lot of our engagement with the world lately. Tap, tap, tapping there on a laptop computer. Here's another kind of engagement with the world. Chopping down a tree in the forest. Oh my, with an axe. With an axe and the whole body involved. 800-423-8255. Guy Claxton joins us from Brighton. We'll go on in a few minutes to Matt Crawford, who looks at making things and what it means to make with our hands, what it does for our understanding of the world. But first, callers for you, Guy. There in Brighton, England, we have a caller from Omaha, Nebraska. Stuart, you're on with Guy Claxton.
Yeah, how you doing today?
All right, what do you think, Stuart?
Yeah, I think what the doctor, I think he's a doctor or a philosopher, is trying to get at is that Western thought has taken out the concept of intuition and made everything purely rational, simply because, you know, those things that they felt were not tangible or things that you can ascertain with the five senses did not exist. So maybe the doctor should look more toward ancient African civilization, who had a good concept of that, of how you use intuition to form the picture, which gives people insight into cause and effect of their actions, to maybe help him solve that problem.
Stuart, I'm very glad for that. What about the cultural map through time or geographically of how humans looked at all this, Guy?
I think it's a really good it's a really good point. I mean, in a way, a big part of what I'm talking about is the neglect of intuition. There are ways in which we know things that come to us which are of great value, but which are not necessarily clear-cut and rational and capable of immediately being put into clear prose and propositions. There's a very interesting study, I think it's still ongoing, of Nobel Prize winners. When they go to collect their prize, the science laureates, when they go to Stockholm to collect their prize, mm-hmm. For many years, they've been asked if they'll take part in a videotaped interview. And one of the questions in that interview concerns the role of intuition in their scientific program, their scientific journey. And the last time I read a report from this project, something like 79 out of 84 of these icons of rationality, these supremely clever, intelligent people, overwhelmingly, they said they couldn't have done it without their intuition. They couldn't have done it without heeding the little nudges and inklings in their bodies, things that they couldn't justify or couldn't explain clearly at the time, but which they had a strong feeling had some validity. Now, of course, gut feelings can lead you astray. I'm not saying abandon your rationality and go completely gut, but there is a middle path in which we heed our intuitions, what's going on in our bodies, with what I call skeptical respect. So not uncritically, but neither denying them as they go along. And there are all kinds of evidence and experience which suggests that we impoverish our understanding of the world, just as Stuart suggested, if we neglect those forms of understanding which come to us in images or in a more embodied kind of way. So I would absolutely agree with him, and I think, of course, there are many other cultures, not only African, Asian, Native American, many other cultures that have perhaps had a better balanced view of how we make ourselves as smart as possible than we've come to in many bits of more Western civilization.
But you say overall we're moving in the other direction. You say over the last century human beings in affluent societies have become more and more sluggish. Our functional bodies have shrunk. What do you mean? What are you describing there?
Well, I think just look at the concern. Well, certainly in England, where I'm based at the moment, with couch potatoes and school children who don't exercise and obesity, there's almost a kind of aversion to physical exercise, physical activity. And there's certainly, I know Matt Crawford will maybe talk about this, there's certainly a very unjust lack of esteem in the education system for people who are exquisitely clever with their hands or with their feet, people whose intelligence manifests through intricate forms of craft or performance or making. And they've been led by generations of education to feel that those forms of excellence are somehow less worthy, less valuable, less intelligent than people who do clever things with words and symbols. And I think we need to rebalance our esteem there, because, as I say, I think it's an injustice to treat physical activities as if they were somehow necessarily of less value or less worth than other kinds of things. After all, there are all kinds of mediocre intellectual activities out there. Just because you're being intellectual, it doesn't mean you're being truly intelligent. And just because you're doing things with your hands, that doesn't mean you're smart either. You can be smart either way, and you can be dumb either way.
Guy Claxton writes, young people who prefer doing intricate things with their bodies, breakdancing, skateboarding, to doing math homework, are not lacking in intelligence, he says. He says, I think they're part of a growing cultural rebellion against the hegemony of the intellect. Michael in Duluth, Minnesota. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I've been a dancer for 40 years or longer. I've been choreographing and dancing for a long, long time, and I've run across, this is really close to what I've been thinking about for 20 years. My point of view is that there are four aspects of the human being. There's the body, the intellect, the spirit or consciousness that we're cradled in, and the emotions. The emotions are our body's response to what we think, which is Eckhart Tolle said that years ago. But there are four ways that these intelligences are demonstrated. And when I tell my dancers that when they learn something, when I want to teach them something, I tell them to trust their body. Their body's got a billion years of DNA information that it is feeding to them. Our intellect, our brain, is only giving us about 200,000 or 300,000 years of information. The least trustworthy information that we get is coming from our brain. But it's all one thing. and this is demonstrated. I'm going to make a big point here. I don't know if anybody will agree with me or not, but I'm going to make a large point to show this on a world scale. I look at the Middle East through Russia, Italy through Russia, as the emotional center of the human race being demonstrated. Our spiritual center or consciousness center is India, China, and Japan. Our physical extension is Africa. You can look at South America, parts of South America, and Cuba as being the physical demonstration. And that the intellectual demonstration is Western Europe and the United States. And these four aspects of the human being have been pushed in the strength for each of those four areas, and that they're merging now. We're seeing a merging of those four aspects of the human being. We're seeing that on a world scale.
Michael, I don't know, that's a pretty wide brush you're painting the world with there, but I'm curious about, Guy, your response to our dancer in Duluth.
I was right with you, Michael, until you started carving up the world, and then I thought, there's a very broad generalization. So there's a lot of intellect in Asia. There's a lot of emotion in different cultures. But I see what you're up to, and the underlying point, I think, is really valid and close to what's now emerging from the science. I've recently done a fair bit of work with dancers myself in the UK, and they're absolutely classic cases in point of the kinds of things that we're talking about here. Of course, there are wisdoms, there are impulses, there is elegance, and I think it's the right word to say that there is intelligence that our bodies have in the way they move, in the way they respond, which we shouldn't separate off. So, like you, Michael, I'm trying to get a more balanced and a more holistic view, and I think dancing is a brilliant case in point for making these things really clear. Whether we can carve them up into different countries of the world, I'm a bit. I'd need to think more about that. But as a metaphor, I can see where you're going with it.
To our caller Stuart earlier from Omaha, you write that you say cognitive scientists no longer believe that the mind is an ethereal source of control sent to curb the body's waywardness and compensate for its stupidity. But a lot of Western thought has been put into containing and controlling body impulses. Has it not, Guy?
Yes, it has. And that's, again, the issue is about balance, isn't it? It's like, you know, all our cars have both an accelerator and a brake. You need the two sides in order to function, for your automobile to function intelligently. So we have evolved, and many other animal species have evolved, both a kind of spontaneous, immediate system for action, and another system which is able to say, hold on a minute, just hold that thought, let's think about that a little bit more. Because if you have the brake and the accelerator, then you can perform much more intricate maneuvers in your world, just as a car can. So it's not, it shouldn't be either or. We should see these two sides of ourselves as being, to go back to Michael's world, as dancing partners, rather than as things that are in competition with each other. But unfortunately, within our culture, particularly, and here quote in quotes, Western cultures, we've sort of treated the restrained part as if it were somehow or other the higher part, and the other part as if it were lower. And that, I think, is where we've gone wrong. If we treat them as equal partners, we get a more accurate view of us as human beings and of our intelligence, I think.
Gabrielle is calling from Dayton, Ohio. Gabrielle, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello. What's your story?
I talk about body memories, and I found that accidentally. I'm now 77, and I was 5 years at the end of the war, and I went 20 years ago to a new neurosurgeon whose practice was deep in, built in a hill, in the front room where I waited, I was fine. As soon as he took me back to the examining room, I cried and cried and cried, and he couldn't examine me. So
what triggered that? What triggered that, Gabriel? You were thinking back to World War II wartime experience?
I found out talking to a psychology student, a friend of my daughter's, who studied engineering, and she said, "What happened there?" I said, "I don't know." And I have the doctor's letters the second time I come in. He said, "I could not examine her. She just cried and cried." And she said, "How did it smell?" And I said, "It smelled like the deep basement. We were in a basement, two flights down in
hiding,
the war.
Hiding in, for 5 years
hiding
in World
from
War
II. The bombing.
Good heavens,
yes.
Yeah.
And my heart goes out to all these young kids now who are under bombardments again. And this is I was 5 years old in the end of the war.
Wow. Gabrielle, I appreciate your call. Guy Claxton, the sense of smell, we all know brings memories very powerfully back. Is that part of the body intelligence you're speaking of?
Well, absolutely. Marcel Proust wrote 13 volumes of a book stimulated by a smell. But I think what Gabriella is saying is crucially important. And one way of describing the point from my point of view is to say another of these oppositions that we've fallen into as a culture is the opposition between intellect and emotion. And they're not separate. You know, intellect is not subversive of understanding, of living a rich, intelligent, subtle life. They need to go together. So when you're understanding something in a doctor's surgery or in a therapist's consulting room, your understanding, your healing, your deepening of your grasp on the meaning of your life is often accompanied by physical sensations, by the welling up of tears, by evocative memories that are produced by smells. We are all of a piece. Those smells, those tears are all of a piece with the words and the understanding. Why do we try and pull them apart and say dry, arid intellect, good, passionate, juicy emotion, bad? Sometimes they can be in conflict. Most of the time, they are different sides of our whole humanity and to be celebrated and integrated.
Given all the ways in which we're not using our bodies, our hands, physical labor as we once did, even engagement with nature as we once did, I mean, your theory suggests we're losing intelligence even as we protest we're gaining it.
Well, I think we are. There's one study by an American researcher called Barbara Rogoff, which I refer to in the book, which looks at kids learning in different cultures. There were kids in an American city and in a Mayan civilization, Mayan culture in Mexico. And one group of kids, the Mayan kids, turned out to be much better at learning through observation. And the American kids were better at learning through thinking and intellect. And the American kids weren't so good at learning through observation. They'd lost the ability to use their eyes and were only using their minds. Let's have both.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about human intelligence way beyond the brain. The intelligence often untapped these days, as my guest, throughout the human body. Guy Claxton is author of Intelligence in the Flesh. He joins us from Brighton, England. Lots of folks writing into us here. Hello Kitty says, I grew up dancing, ballet. Have to say I feel a greater sense of commune with my body than a lot of people. Ballet taught me to always listen to my body, listen to pain and joy. Ark says, intense physical labor is fine when you're a species designed to live to 35. I'm only 40 and I'm starting to feel the weight of those labors.
Third Way Forward writes, whenever I hear people invoking the body, it's kind of cryptic dog whistle reference, I think. They must be postmodernist, essentialist, feminist, Heideggerians. It'd be interesting if you'd get down to the nitty-gritty of mysticism associated with the body. The flesh is always of interest. But, Guy Claxton, is there a kind of mysticism you're engaging here? Third Way Forward, here's a dog whistle.
I don't see it as being mystical, although I do think there are forms of religion. The religions differ quite a lot in the way they relate to the body, and some of them seem to have a rather hostile reaction to the body as being, you know, the home of corruption and bestiality and lustfulness, and other religions around the world seem to have a rather more harmonious attitude towards the body and the physical makeup. So whether it's spiritual or not, I don't know. Although, I mean, we may come on to talk a little bit about mindfulness and the role of consciousness in all of this. But I certainly think it's fundamentally the way we think about our body as being part of our identity is fundamentally important to our well-being. I wouldn't put it any stronger than that, perhaps.
Guy Claxton, stand by in Brighton, England. Matthew Crawford joins us right now from Richmond, Virginia. He's author of The World Beyond Your Head and Shop Class as Soul Craft, senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture. He's also got a motorcycle repair shop down that way. Matt Crawford, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
When people get their hands on the tools and the wrenches and into the physical labor, do you see something, some other dimension of intelligence emerging?
Well, I think what you guys were talking about earlier about sort of cognitive extension is interesting. I think it's in skilled activities that the role of the body in understanding the world really becomes most clear. And consider the problem of catching a fly ball. On the sort of understanding that Guy is criticizing, you would suppose that we have somewhere in our minds, you know, a parabola, some mental representation of the trajectories that balls follow. But it turns out that what we do is we start running, and once, you know, you've tried this a number of times, you discover that if you run in such a way that the ball appears to be moving in a straight line at constant speed, that puts you in the right spot to catch the ball. So that's just a nice, clear example of how we don't always rely on internal mental representations to solve a problem in the world. Sometimes the world is its own best model. So in trying to kind of put the mind back in the world through the body, I think what Guy is up to is very important culturally, not just because you know, we've devalued shop class and manual work, but more broadly, I think our experience of the world has come to be mediated by representations ever more. We're sort of encountering the world through a screen, through what are really manufactured experiences. And as human experience becomes more highly engineered in this way, it becomes more manipulable, and we become sort of passive consumers of manufactured experiences.
Are we risking or undergoing an intelligence downgrade with that remove?
I think so. I think it's you could think of it as becoming stupider in a sense, but you could also think of it as becoming more easily manipulated insofar as your sort of basic sensory motor equipment for grasping the world and negotiating it falls into disuse. You become ever more reliant on sort of mediated encounters with the world where somebody is holding your hand.
Is it salvageable? Take that screen person and put them in the shop class or the motorcycle repair shop for a year. Do you see something grow?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much emphasis to really put on physicality here. I think that the bottom issue may be rather that you're dealing with stuff that hasn't been sort of designed around you in order to cater to your tastes. I mean, think about like video games and how they tap into this hardwired need for novelty and excitement that comes at a certain pace. There's a kind of behaviorist conditioning that it accomplishes, where it's all kind of designed to be gratifying and pleasing. Mm-hmm. And that I think that can make us impatient with the real world, because the real world starts to seem just kind of drab and unexciting by comparison.
The Doritos of experience up against, I don't know, just a regular potato.
Yeah, right, hyper-palatable experiences. So, right, distractibility could be regarded as the mental equivalent of obesity.
Callers for the two of you. Brian in Montreal, Canada. Brian, you're on the air with Matt Crawford and Guy Claxton.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Guy. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to throw into the picture my life experience, and I'll try and be really brief about it. Yeah. I'm the son of a really, really physically active Swedish father, and he took me out in the forest from age two on his back. So here in the North Woods, I was traveling through the North Woods in the snow, which is practically hard to track.
Yeah.
As a consequence of that very childhood experience, I actually rarely get lost, because I don't even have to think about it. I don't recall physically where I've been, what steps I've taken. My body pretty almost always tells me, no, you're pointed the wrong way. And when I turn the right way, I actually feel it. I don't have to think about it. I have another experience that I wanted to fly by everyone. I'm a very rational man. I trained as an engineer, and that's because my dad's physicality pointed me that way. He was really good at it with his hands, and that made me feel really great learning to manipulate the world in more sophisticated ways. But in chem lab in high school, I got a nose full of chlorine gas.
Ooh.
I was doing what I wasn't supposed to do, and I think I fried most of my sinus cavities and any of the sensory organs that are there. A consequence of that is I lost a lot of emotional input that everybody else takes for granted. I have to decide whether food is safe to eat because I can't smell it. I have to walk into a sewer and know that I should be extremely conscious where other people just feel disgust and want to get out there as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole range of decisions that other people, normal people, make with a combination of their gut and their mind and their bodies that I have to, lacking this nasal input, can't do with anything but my brain. And the final part I want to throw is I'm one of the last people in my circle of friends who learned how to do their calculations with a slide rule. I'm that old. I have, as a consequence, a double check, a double entry bookkeeping system on all the engineering decisions I make that make it much easier for me to pick out flaws, because I literally worked with my hands to figure out the size of numbers that should be right. And other people who only see it on screen or a printout, I know for a fact they have not that ease in finding errors because they haven't worked it out with their hands.
Brian, that's a marvelous basket of things. Some tough there. Sorry for the loss of smell, but fascinating. Guy, respond to that from the snowy direction certainty to the loss of nose, and with that immediate sense of disgust, to slide rule and math.
I think what we're talking about is something very important and something in common. It's great, by the way, to be talking with Matt. The last time I saw him, we were having a drink in a pub in London about 3 months ago. So, hi, Matt.
Hey.
There's something in Matt's work and in my work and in what your caller has just said, which is about the importance of attention. Not comprehension, not thinking, not analyzing, but there's something deeply important about the quality of attention that we are capable of giving to ourselves, to our inner life, to the world of the senses, and to other people. And maybe one of the common threads here is that we rush into categorizing, into articulating, and lose some of that more patient but more detailed information that comes through simply paying attention, being present to a complex situation. And we were talking about spirituality a little while ago. I don't know about that, but I think there is something of wisdom in being able to be present, particularly to complex or hard situations. They might be social situations, or they might be the kinds of situations that Matt has written about, particularly in his latest book, The World Beyond Our Heads, where you're working with recalcitrant material. It might be organ pipes that are very difficult to tune, or other craft material. And there is something in the discipline of having to be fully present. Not thinking about is part of it, but if we're rushing into analytical thought and aren't there with our hands, our slide rules, our images, our senses as well, then, as I say, I think we find ourselves playing with only half of a deck rather than being able to play with the full deck in life. And playing with the full deck not only makes us smarter, but I suspect makes us happier as well.
Guy Claxton, author of Intelligence in the Flesh, Matthew Crawford, author of The World Beyond Your Head, Mike in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I think it's obligatory, especially since your guest lives in Britain, for him to interview Stephen Hawking, whose body has become a complete shambles, and ask him if it has affected his mind to any extent.
That's a wonderful point. Guy Claxton, is Stephen Hawking a sort of living, breathing refutation to your description of this necessity?
It's really interesting. It's a really good point, Mike. Thanks. I haven't met Stephen Hawking, but the question I would want to ask him, I don't think the shambles of his body is the issue. The question that I will want to talk to him about is what has happened to his intuition, is his sensitivity, is his receptivity to those hunches or promptings, which the evidence has shown, and I was talking about a little while ago, is really important to high-level scientists, and I suspect mathematicians as well. I wonder I would want to have that conversation with Stephen Hawking, not whether he can walk or talk. I don't think that's the crucial issue. This is not about being athletic or muscular or able-bodied. It's about what we do with our attention and the aspect of that attention which benefits us if we can pay attention to ourselves, to our viscerality and our muscularity, as well as to our thoughts and our images and our senses.
It would be fun to host that exchange right here one day, Guy Claxton and Stephen Hawking. Andrew,
let's do it. Let's set it up, Tom.
Andrew, Providence, Rhode Island. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Quick observation from a physician and medical educator.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a real decline in the skills of physicians in terms of interviewing and examining patients because young physicians and trainees are looking at screens where there's a deluge, an avalanche of data. And I think this is causing serious problems in terms of progress in medical education.
You mean instead of looking into the eyes or the body of the patient?
Instead of looking at the patient, putting hands on the patient, they're looking at screens. And that's to the detriment of medicine in this country and around the Western world.
And as we talk about more and more data flows, it's a great point. Our time grows so short, but I'm happy for that, Andrew. One more, if I may. Omaha, Nebraska. Rebecca, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I was calling from an artist's point of view. I'm an artist, and I studied art history, and I think that intuition and the body have a lot to do with creativity and making artwork, but also throughout history I've noticed that there's been a pendulum swing between classical and romantic thought, and you can really see, you know, the emphasis in culture go between the rational and the intellectual side of the brain and then the emotional and gut feeling side of the brain. And to see that go throughout time, our guests think that our society needs a shift again towards the romantic side of our beings, and does he see that in this context of history?
That's a wonderful question, Rebecca. Matt, let me put it first to you. Are we in the midst of it right now with all the interest in yoga and meditation and beyond? Do you see a pendulum shift underway?
I don't know, Tom. I guess it would make me I hope the alternatives aren't mysticism and the narrow kind of rationalism that Guy is criticizing. I think a fuller account of reason will help us integrate the body and the sort of narrower intellect as more narrowly understood. And to take the case of Stephen Hawking, I think no one is contesting that there is a certain kind of thinking, namely highly theoretical, abstract thinking, that does not rely on the body. So it wouldn't be surprising that someone whose body is ravaged might be an outstanding mathematical physicist. I think that the point is rather that in everyday cognition, as we sort of negotiate the world, the body plays an indispensable role, and that's quite different than figuring out black holes.
So sail on, Stephen Hawking. Matthew Crawford, author of The World Beyond Your Head and Shop Class as Soul Craft. Thanks a lot for being with us today, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Guy Claxton, this has really been a treat. Terrific book, and thanks for all your insights with us today. Thanks for joining us from Brighton.
It's been my pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Guy Claxton, author of Intelligence in the Flesh. There's an excerpt at our website worth checking out, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.